We are joined live in the studios by Maria Tomczyk, local writer and activist, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
All right, no job today. He decided to visit his home away from home. Oh, Maria's giving me the signal
that I need my headphones turned on.
Power up the guest phone.
So Mike, Jav is out this week. He had to visit the hospital briefly this week. Hopefully they'll release him soon.
Supposedly he's getting out today.
Yeah.
He's breaking out today. So, all right. So with that, we still, amazingly, the city and country continue to crank out the items this week.
They do.
Big announcement, at least from the county and city standpoint, about homelessness.
Yeah. Mayor Durkin and King County Executive Dow Constantine announced a bill for a new King County Regional Homelessness Authority, which they are submitting to both the King County Council and the Seattle City Council for approval. Both the city and county's homelessness budgets and departments would be merged into the new regional entity, which would be run as a public development authority, which is a public corporation, and that corporation would be separate from any state, county, or city government, and it would be able to accept funds from both public and private sources. PDAs, that's the abbreviation for Public Development Authority, are usually set up whenever a city or county has a job that the city or county government doesn't really want to directly handle itself.
So like managing a stadium.
Yeah, yeah. Or including the administration of a program that relies primarily on federal funding, or is a large chunk of it is federal funding. Some examples, in addition to like a stadium authority, include the Agency for Culture, which you've maybe heard of. They engage in arts funding, public art, and heritage programs throughout King County. Another example would be the Seattle Chinatown International District Preservation and Development Authority. The Pike Place Market Preservation and Development Authority is another example. And at least in Washington State, PDAs are often used to acquire land and build and maintain facilities, for example, for parks, for a park, maybe, or a museum, a convention center, like the Bellevue Meidenbauer Place is run by the Bellevue PDA. Or a historic district like the Seattle Chinatown International District, but not always. And this is one of those exceptions where it's being used for something completely different. Of course, the main problem with setting up this as a regional PDA to handle services for the homelessness population, is that function really is, you could argue that function really is a responsibility of local government. And dumping it into a regional PDA removes it from the oversight of the city council, the Seattle City Council, and by extension by the citizens of Seattle, who can call up or email their city council member who represents them in their district and say, hey, I think you need to make a shift in how you spend your money on homelessness services, et cetera. When you put it into a regional agency, then the question becomes, who do I call to express my dissatisfaction? You know, does the PDA advisory board meet regularly? When do they meet? You know, do they take public comment like the city council does, et cetera?
Should reduce the temperature when people are up for re-election too.
Yeah. Now the new PDA has a convoluted governance structure that involves both a governing board and a steering committee, as well as an executive director. Now, the governing board is supposed to be responsible for the day-to-day operations of the PDA, while the steering committee is responsible for oversight of the governing board. But the governing board makes major financial decisions and draws up its own annual budget and a five-year plan, which the steering committee is empowered only to approve without making any amendments or changes to either the annual budget or the five-year plan. So much for oversight there. So who sits on these two bodies? The governing board, which will run day-to-day operations, would be composed of two people appointed by Mayor Jenny Durkin, two people appointed by King County Executive Dow Constantine, two people appointed by the Seattle City Council, two people appointed by the King County Council, and then three people appointed by two members of the steering committee, the two members who've directly experienced homelessness. Okay, so there is homelessness, there is representation on the governing board of homeless people, but they're the minority, only three of 11 folks on the governing board. Elected officials and employees of the city of Seattle or King County and current contract holders who provide homelessness services and take money from the city of Seattle or the federal government or King County to do that would not be able to sit on the governing board. But there are no other guidelines regarding who should be appointed to the governing board except this wording in the new plan. And the wording reads, quote, "The governing board shall be comprised of individuals who have connections to or experience with a broad range of stakeholders and communities, including but not limited to the local business community, neighborhood and community associations, faith, religious groups, and the philanthropic community." And then that's followed by some general wording about race and gender equity and geographical representation. And that's it. And that's a very, very broad definition of who's qualified to make these major decisions about how the homeless are treated in Seattle and King County. And remember, none of these folks will be directly elected by voters. They'll be chosen by the mayor, the county executive, and both councils for the most part. So there's nothing there that says you have to have experience of homelessness. You have to have a degree in anything. You have to have some kind of knowledge of housing issues and homelessness issues. There's nothing in there about that. It's all just really, really broad. And you'll notice who was listed first there was representatives of the business community. Yeah.
Because they always come first.
They always come first, yeah. Now, the steering committee can hire and fire governing board members. The steering committee is supposed to oversee the governing board, right? Mm-hmm. The members of the steering committee are Mayor Jenny Durkin, King County Executive Dow Constantine.
Who each already have selected for the members.
Yeah, members of the, yeah, exactly. Okay. One Seattle City Council member, one King County Council member, one officer of the board of directors of the Sound Cities Association, or if other cities join with the regional authority, it'd be one representative from those cities, and then two people who've experienced homelessness at some point in their lives, who will be appointed by some newly made up group that has a majority of representatives on it who've experienced homelessness at some point in their lives. So again, there's some token representation there for homeless people on the steering committee. But again, people who are currently homeless or recently have experienced homelessness in Seattle and King County are probably not going to make the cut for the steering committee and the governing board. Although I would guess Zachary DeWolf would probably be a shoe-in for one of those spots. Now, this PDA will control $128 million. In federal, county, and city funds for homelessness services, including homeless shelters, transitional housing, permanent supportive housing, rapid rehousing services, diversion, outreach, and homelessness prevention services. So they'll be in control of all of that. The city of Seattle is only going to retain two things from what they currently do in terms of homelessness services. And these two things are the budget for acquiring and building affordable housing, so the capital budget for affordable housing, and the navigation team. And that really points out to me that the navigation team really has never been part of the Seattle's response to homelessness. It's really been part of the police department anyway, right?
Yeah.
Because that's not going to be part of the regional authority. It's still going to be run by, as Mayor Durkin's pet project. Now, the PDA is not meant to be a permanent body. It will issue an annual report and request an annual renewal of its authority Seattle City Council and the King County Council. But neither Seattle nor King County can withdraw from the PDA in the first 5 years. So they're going to be committed to it for the first 5 years, after which when it comes up for annual renewal, they may be able to withdraw. So reversing course on the PDA, if it fails, is going to be really, really difficult and could be potentially very costly after we've been committed to it for 5 years. So that's worth considering too. Notably, while the new plan to set up the PDA might be rubber stamped by the Seattle City Council, conservative members of the King County Council are already beginning to dig in their heels. Republican Reagan Dunn, who represents the 9th District, that's South Bellevue, Maple Valley, Enumclaw, and southeast rural areas of King County, has already come out against the PDA, saying that Seattle is just trying to impose its values on the rest of King County, and that he's going to do his best to either amend the PDA agreement to his satisfaction or to overturn it so that it won't take effect. Of course, the reverse could turn out to be true if the PDA does get approved by both the Seattle City Council and the King County Council, especially if other cities in King County join the PDA or gain representation on the steering committee and the governing board. So I think we need to ask ourselves here in the city of Seattle the question, particularly since we have the bulk of the homeless population in King County, are we sure that we want the city of Sammamish, for example, to have a say in how we treat our homeless community? So I think that's a very serious question that the Seattle City Council needs to ask before they just rubber stamp the plan for this new regional authority.
Well, I would imagine that the Chamber of Commerce and its members would be pretty happy with this
arrangement. Oh, yeah. And they seem to be really
very
happy.
Well represented.
Well, no, they're right up there, I'm sure, talking with Dow Constantine and in particular Mayor Durkin about who they want to sit on those boards. But yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. Okay. Any more on that?
That's the status. Like I said, the mayor and the county executive have submitted their plans to the Seattle City Council and to the King County Council. And we'll see how at least the Seattle City Council decides to take up and hear the plan, whether it'll be the full council or whether it'll go through a committee. I'm not sure which yet.
All right.
I'm sure Mayor Durkin's going to lobby really hard for the full council to hear it because she doesn't want it to go into Shama Sawant's committee for sure.
Mm. So. Yeah. It still might go through both.
It might. So we'll see.
We'll wait and see. All right. Well, speaking of the Seattle City Council, mm-hmm. they wrestled with other issues this week, including bicycles.
Yeah, there were some bills that were passed by the Seattle City Council this week. Among those were three bills related to bicycles in the city of Seattle. The City Council voted to pass one ordinance and two resolutions on bicycles. First off, an ordinance requiring that the Seattle Department of Transportation build bike lanes on any roads that they are repaving that are also listed in the Bicycle Master Plan. This is in response to the city ditching the bicycle lane that was planned for 35th Avenue Northeast when it was recently repaved due to cost concerns, as Stott said, but mostly because some neighborhood residents complained about putting a bicycle lane on 35th Avenue Northeast.
There was, serious pushback on that.
Yeah. Now, the second thing that the council passed was a resolution asking the mayor to make a commitment to build out the Bicycle Master Plan and to identify funding for a specific list of projects, especially projects that benefit South Seattle, which is South Seattle has not gotten a whole lot of attention yet from the city in terms of building bicycle lanes and infrastructure for riding bikes in the city of Seattle. Because this resolution is non-binding, Durkin is, of course, free to ignore it, which she probably will. But Mike O'Brien, who sponsored all three of these bills, is clearly going to make use of this resolution when budget time rolls around, and budget time is already almost upon us. And he could use it as a reason to make changes to SDOT's budget in the upcoming budget negotiations. Now, the third bill that was passed is a resolution asking SDOT, the Seattle Department of Transportation, to come up with a budget for creating more on-street parking spaces for bicycles and also potentially for electric scooters, which the city is still investigating whether or not they want to bring in electric scooters. There's a little bit of on-street parking, and the Seattle Department of Transportation has said that they had a goal of making space for 1,500 bicycles to park in parking spaces rather than on sidewalks. That's not very many given the number of of bicycles that Lime Bike and Jump have spread out around the city of Seattle.
Yeah, not to mention people's personal bikes.
Yeah, and so and some of these new bicycle parking spaces, I think in addition to actually creating them, SDOT needs to invest some money in educating people that they're where they are, that they're there, and that they can use them not just for personal bicycles, but also for bike share bicycles. Because on my block, there is a parking space that's been devoted to bicycle parking. It's a beautiful space. It's when I walk by it, it's often empty. And when I just turn the corner, within literally a few feet of the bicycle parking space, you see bike share bicycles parked on the sidewalk.
Yeah.
So I think SDOT needs to do a better job of educating people about bicycle parking, as you know, how to properly park bike share bicycles, but also that these spaces exist where they are and that you can use them not just for personal bikes that need to be locked up, but also for bike share bikes.
Maybe they could actually have it as part of the app or an advertisement that comes up right before the app that you use to actually activate these bicycles.
Yeah, yeah. Here's how to park. Here's where to park. And here's a little button you can push if you need to find a parking space.
Here's what you'll be charged if you don't put the bike back in a proper parking spot.
That's a whole nother enforcement mechanism. That's not that the city could investigate, actually. Yeah. Rather than just simply fining or limiting the number of bikes that the bike share companies can put out on the street if their bikes are not parked properly, which has been the way it's been done so far. Now, but Mike O'Brien has been busy trying to push as much green legislation as he can through his Sustainability and Transportation Committee. And this week, along with the Mercer Megablock proposal, he introduced a new bill that would ban gas utility hookups in new buildings in Seattle. Now, the Mercer Megablock proposal was discussed in committee and will be discussed again in future committee meetings, but no vote was taken on it yet this week. It appeared that the main discussion this week was on very minor aspects of the Megablock proposal, like perhaps tasking the city with trying to negotiate a daycare center as well. Yeah. At least maybe as part of the community center portion of the Megablock proposal, they did not discuss the affordable housing portion of it.
I think it's going to the main council from here.
Yeah, I think so too. That's been my impression, is that it's more or less a done deal when it was presented to the Seattle City Council, and that most council members are okay with it. That trying to get it overturned is going to be a really hard uphill slog, and that activists should be saying, okay, we can't do much about the mega block, but let's look at some of our future proposals. Like, for example, the mayor this week announced that the city was turning over 3 public parcels for affordable housing. Well, if you look at the affordable housing, it's going to be to build, 27 condos and townhomes. But the cost per unit is well over $300,000 to build those. And how many families is it going to house?
Well, and it's aimed at people making 80% of median income, I think.
Yeah, again, which is like, workforce housing, which again is really high up there. It's not really serving.
It's not helping the people that need it.
Helping the people who need it most, the people who are at the verge of becoming homeless because they simply don't make up to 80% of median income. They don't make enough to afford rent. They don't make enough to afford rent in workforce housing. So the city really needs to get its priorities straight. And that's where I think housing activists and other activists need to focus the discussion on is, okay, what are we doing to create public housing for people who really need it? So anyway, I want to talk also about Michael Bryan's bill on gas hookups.
Yes.
Because he's really taken seriously the Green New Deal. Which recently passed the city council, and he is trying to announce and get in the works as many bills as he can before his term is up on the city council. Before he runs out of gas, yeah. Now, this bill banning gas utility hookups in new buildings in Seattle, that really came as a shock to developers and their allies, including the folks who write articles at the Seattle Times. Just like oil companies and the Republican Party, real estate developers are very heavily invested in the idea that natural gas is a quote-unquote clean fuel when it comes to greenhouse gas emissions. But studies have shown that fracking which is where most of Seattle's natural gas comes from, can leave local communities both heavily polluted, and that it also contributes, as well as natural gas storage facilities and pipelines, to releasing large amounts of methane into the atmosphere. Methane is a greenhouse gas that's 80 times more potent than carbon dioxide at trapping heat in the atmosphere. Now, in identifying the main sources of greenhouse gas emissions in Seattle, the city of Seattle determined that transportation is the number one. It makes up the main, and this is primarily passenger automobiles, make up the majority of greenhouse gas emissions in the city at 62.5%. Now, the rest, which is still a really sizable chunk, is mostly composed of energy to heat buildings and to heat commercial buildings and homes. And almost three quarters of those emissions are from natural gas for both homes and for commercial buildings. Electricity in Seattle, if you have an electric heat rather than gas heat, is now carbon neutral and has been for at least the past 14 years, although it's still got a ways to go to be zero emission electricity. Now, with this bill, O'Brien is trying to eliminate the second biggest source of emissions in the city. His bill would, number one, prohibit any new buildings built after July 1st, 2020 from installing natural gas piping systems. And number two, it would direct the Department of Construction and Inspections to recommend changes to the Seattle Municipal Code that would extend that law to existing buildings that undergo renovations and additions. The bill was introduced and discussed in committee this week, but no vote has been taken as yet. Developers, of course, will be lobbying the city council hard to amend or stall or kill the bill. In addition to Mike O'Brien, who's the chair of the Sustainability and Transportation Committee, members of the committee include Vice Chair Abel Pacheco, who has been open to listening to the business side of every argument.
That's putting it very nicely.
Yeah, that's putting it quite nicely. And Shama Sawant, who has been the opposite. So it's an interesting committee. Bruce Harrell is an alternate, and he sometimes sits in on those committee meetings as well, particularly when there's an important bill heard. And he has also been very friendly, very business friendly. So it's possible that the bill won't make it out of committee. It's also quite possible that no action will be taken on it until after Mike O'Brien has left the city council. Mm-hmm. Consider the fact that budget negotiations are going to take up city council time here pretty quickly, as soon as the mayor releases her budget to the city council, which is usually expected by mid-September. Then the city council pretty much puts all their other committee meetings on hold and starts working on the budget, and they usually work on the budget through the end of November with the goal of trying to get a budget passed by Thanksgiving.
So it was one of the items that was I was watching the yesterday's.
You were
that
watching
was when
that
the
meeting.
Committee was.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I was watching it mainly because I wanted to see what the Mercer Mega Block giveaway, any developments on that. And so they had public comment before that, and mm-hmm. actually the bulk of the public comment that came in was on that particular issue.
Bill.
And it
yeah.
was not unanimously, but pretty much it was all different industries represented there. And it was interesting that
which industries?
Well, I think there was one from like the gas, natural gas folks, although mm-hmm. I can't remember specifically what there was. But it was more the building people, building mm-hmm. industries, and development folks, and it was amazing their love and their defense for their friends over in the gas industry. They appeared that they were really concerned
like
about
said,
them losing jobs.
Yeah, they're heavily invested in this idea that natural gas is a clean energy, and real estate developers and the oil and gas industry, they're like hand in hand on this.
Yeah,
and
so
in lockstep on this.
But again, the loss of jobs, where it's like, well, you know, they're not eliminating. This is just on new. Mm-hmm. New buildings going in. So it's like you're not going to look at a major loss of jobs unless you're anticipating, you know, a industry that's dependent on constant growth, which many of our industries
which,
are.
Yeah. I mean, that's capitalism for you.
But
constant
still,
growth,
you know, the old
the norm,
the existing pipes, you know, are going to need
we'll
servicing.
Be there. And, yeah, they're grandfathered in.
And it also brings up one final quick item on this is as someone that has, I have gas at my residence, and also electricity. But electricity is never a constant. I mean, the city, if it is going to require people to be dependent upon electricity, they really are going to have to up their infrastructure, because I've had power go out in our neighborhood, you know, half a dozen times for significant periods in the last year.
Yeah. You know, so. Now, on the other hand, you also have solar panels on your roof, which allows you to turn your lights on and cook and get heat when your neighbors are all dark, right?
Exactly.
And that was the point that Mike O'Brien was making with this bill. He was saying, yes, we would be more reliant on the electrical grid. On the other hand, if we push, if we give incentives and we push for more local solar, then that
I think that should definitely take a lot of pressure. That should, all new buildings should have solar.
Yes. That would take a lot of pressure off the electrical grid.
It is. It's great until, you know, the final apocalypse, zombie apocalypse comes. And then you notice you're the only lit house on the street.
Okay, now we know who's been watching too much TV here.
All right. Well, I guess I guess with that, we ought to maybe move on to back to reality on the national news.
Right. Yeah. And I'm just going to take a minute here to remind folks that we're all volunteer, both the station KODX and our program. And if you really like our program and you really are enjoying having KODX be a major resource for you, not just on Saturdays, but all throughout the week, because we have some great programming throughout the week.
We do.
Then show us some love and go to our website at kodxseattle.org. We have a Patreon button there where you can become a regular contributor to the station. Or if you scroll down to the bottom, there's a PayPal button for one-time donations. Folks who don't like making payments over the internet, you can also send us a check. Make it out to Earth on the Air Independent Media and send it to us at P.O. Box 45883, Seattle, Washington, 98145. Again, that's P.O. Box 45883, Seattle, Washington, 98145. And if I remember to, I'll repeat that address at the end of the show.
And big thank you to everybody that contributed this last week. We had both another Patreon subscriber and as we hold in our hand a couple of additional people
checks
have written
that were
old-fashioned checks.
Sent in the mail, yes. And we take those and we love those too. So.
Yeah, it all keeps us going.
Literally, week to week.
Keeps the lights on.
It does.
Because we're not powered by gas here. It's electricity.
Yes. Okay, so national.
On to national. You've been doing a weekly evaluation
of presidential candidates. This week, I decided to focus on economic justice. Last week, it was criminal justice reform. This week, it's economic justice. What plans do the candidates have for helping out folks who are on the lower rungs of the income ladder?
Which are those rungs are growing.
Dealing with income inequality. The candidates all have some things in common. For example, they like to talk about raising up the middle class, reversing Trump's tax cuts for the rich and for corporations, providing health care to all Americans, or at least expanding health care to most Americans, expanding access to higher education and educational opportunities. And in some cases, some candidates talk about free college. And that's becoming more common among the Democratic candidates. They all have plans to revitalize rural America, particularly those farmers who have been hit hard by the Trump trade war. And that's been a sizable chunk of rural America. And they all talk about strengthening labor laws in various ways. But they don't all approach economic justice from the same perspective. So I want to look at the top five polling candidates and how they view economic justice. Now, Joe Biden, I call his plan the Just a Few Tweaks plan. He wants to increase the federal minimum wage to $15 per hour. And to be fair, he was one of the first mainstream Democrats to support that back in 2015 when the Obama administration was supporting a $12 an hour minimum wage. He said, no, it should be $15 per hour. So he's strong on that. He wants to stop companies from classifying low-wage workers as managers to avoid paying overtime. That's commonly referred to as wage theft. And I would say most of the Democratic candidates support that, but that's a central part of his plan. He wants to stop Republicans from gutting the right to form a union and collectively bargain, although he hasn't been real specific on what specific policies he would push in order to do that. He wants to stand up against non-compete clauses that keep people from taking a better paying job at a competitor. And that's a good proposal too. He wants to, quote, put an end to unnecessary occupational licensing requirements, end quote. And he doesn't explain what that means, although to me that sounds suspiciously like a Republican deregulatory proposal there. Now, he wants to increase and, you know, to pay for some of his stuff, he wants to increase taxes on capital gains to the same rate that people pay on wages and salaries, then triple the child tax credit and increase other tax credits for the middle class. Not necessarily for the poorest folks who already probably don't pay taxes, but are still suffering from income inequality. And again, that's, I think, the biggest hole in his plan, is that he focuses mostly on a few tweaks for middle class workers and doesn't address the needs of the poorest Americans, where income inequality is really the most painful and where it's been growing and is become a growing problem. So the Joe Biden plan I refer to as the Just a Few Tweaks plan, and it's mostly for the middle class. Not a huge change from, for example, policies Hillary Clinton would have supported or previous Democrats like the Obama administration. He goes a little bit further, but not a whole lot further. Now, Elizabeth Warren, she's been polling number two in a lot of the polls, although Bernie Sanders is again catching up with her. They're almost neck and neck in other polls, and sometimes Sanders is ahead, sometimes Elizabeth Warren. Elizabeth Warren, her policy I call the tax the rich and break up big tech policy. She would work to pass an ultra-millionaire tax on the 75,000 richest families in the U.S., families that make more than $50 million per year, or what she calls the top 0.1% of Americans. But her tax is not based on their income, it's based on their net wealth or all of the assets that they own. They would pay 2% on every dollar of net worth above $50 million and 3% on every dollar above $1 billion in assets to eventually bring in $2.75 trillion in revenue to the federal government over 10 years. The bill includes a 40% exit tax on any citizen, any such wealthy citizen who renounces their citizenship, who has more than, you know, $50 million in net worth. So that would prevent rich people from saying, oh, I'm just going to become a citizen of the UK or a citizen of the Bahamas, for example. I'm going to go buy up some devastated land in the Bahamas and live there so I don't have to pay the wealth tax in the United States. They would have to give up then 40% of what they own as an exit tax. Now, she would lower the threshold of estates required to pay the estate tax from $22 million down to $7 million, and she would raise that tax rate on estates. She would strengthen, and then she would turn around and she would do a few other things too. She would strengthen antitrust enforcement and break up the three biggest tech companies, Amazon, Google, and Facebook, by declaring their platforms to be platform utilities, then breaking off any units that participate on that platform that those companies own. So for example, Amazon now sells goods on its website as Amazon Marketplace and Basics. It also owns several other retailers that market and sell their products through Amazon.com and connect to Amazon.com, like Zappos, Whole Foods, and Goodreads, for example. It would have to divest the first two of those. Facebook would have to give up WhatsApp and Instagram, and Google would part ways with Nest, which is their smart thermostats company, DoubleClick, which is their big online advertising company, and Waze, which is their GPS navigation app. That's a key part of her trying to break up big Wall Street and try to free up assets in the economy so that there can be a redistribution of wealth. She wants to fund universal childcare that would be free for people making less than 200% of the federal poverty line and be capped at 7% of a family's income for all families. She would work to pass her comprehensive housing bill to invest $500 billion over 10 years to build, preserve, and rehab affordable housing with the goal of bringing down rents by 10% nationwide and creating about 1.5 million new jobs. She would create a down payment assistance program for first-time home buyers who live in formerly redlined neighborhoods or communities that were segregated by law and are still currently low income. She would invest $2 billion to support homeowners who are underwater on their mortgages from the 2008 financial crisis. And she would put stricter limits on when a bank or mortgage holder can force a sale of a property out from under a homeowner. She would allow workers at large corporations to elect at least 40% of the company's board members so that they have more say in the policies of the company that they work for. Now, in line with her background as a bankruptcy lawyer, Warren is most concerned with helping homeowners. She's the author of a study that found most middle-class folks who go through bankruptcy are there because they paid too much for housing or were the victims of mortgage fraud. So that's really where she focuses is on her housing plan. Now, to pay for some of her very expensive plans and to try to level the economic playing field, Warren would tax the super wealthy based not just on their incomes, but on their net wealth. And that's what really on the assets that they own. And that's what really sets her apart from many of the other candidates who want to raise taxes, and particularly taxes on the wealthy. It sets her apart. She's looking not just at what their annual income is, but she's looking at the huge billion-dollar fortunes that they've accumulated under policies that go back, starting with the Reagan administration. So that kind of sets her apart from the other candidates.
Hmm. I thought for a second that when you were first talking about her exit tax, that was her new name for the estate tax.
No. That's entirely different.
Okay.
It's a way to keep millionaires from just fleeing our tax regime and going to another country. More amenable to rich folks. Now, Bernie Sanders, I call his program the Federal Jobs Program. He wants to implement a federal jobs guarantee program that will employ any American who wants a good paying job with the goal of 100% employment in the United States. This includes a green jobs program, a universal daycare program that could hire people, an affordable housing program that would be hiring people, and long-term care program for seniors that would be providing different types of jobs to provide these services back to Americans. He also has a workplace democracy plan that would allow unions the ability to organize through a majority sign-up process. It would require employers to negotiate a first contract with a new union or have one imposed through arbitration, so they can't just ignore the union. It would repeal Section 14B of the Taft-Hartley Act that allows right-to-work laws. It would give federal workers the right to strike. It would require companies that merge to honor existing union contracts. It would ban the permanent replacement of workers who go out on strike. It would protect workers' pensions, guarantee the right to unionize for all workers, and there are many, many other provisions. It's a very comprehensive workplace democracy plan that focuses on workers and their needs. He would enact universal child care and pre-kindergarten programs. He would work to pass the Paycheck Fairness Act to ensure equal pay for women and men. He would guarantee that all workers have paid family and medical leave, paid sick leave, and paid vacation, which is not the case throughout the United States. He has a real Wall Street reform plan, which would include breaking up too big to fail banks, reinstating the Glass-Steagall Act, capping consumer loan and credit card interest rates at 15%. It would impose a financial transactions tax to restrict high-frequency trading, which destabilizes the stock market. And it would provide affordable banking options through post office branches for people who cannot afford the fees that large banks charge, particularly for things like overdrafts. Now, he also has a tax reform plan that would raise taxes on the wealthy and corporations, including raising taxes on capital gains and dividends, which are now taxed at a lower rate than wages. He would increase the top marginal tax rate on incomes over $10 million. It would eliminate offshore tax havens. It would remove the wage cap on Social Security taxes so that the wealthy would pay more into the Social Security system to shore that up. And it would close other tax loopholes for rich folks and big corporations. But again, his tax reform policy is based on annual income, how much money people and companies make per year, not on your nest egg, the super wealthy, what the big, huge fortunes that the super wealthy are sitting on. That's what Elizabeth Warren would be targeting. Sanders federal jobs program looks a lot like the New Deal legislation of the 30s and 40s, and he even compares it to that. Given that our income inequality is as bad or worse than it was during the Great Depression, with record numbers of homeless people in many of our major cities, this looks like a really good plan to a lot of people, and it looks like a really good idea to me. But there's, of course, the question of whether his tax reforms and his federal jobs program will tax reforms will be able to pay for full employment and for some of the things that he wants to do, and whether he can get Congress behind him in passing some of these things. That's going to be a big if for Elizabeth Warren as well.
When you mentioned the overdraft fees, that remind me, I just looked at Googled it really quick, but in 2017, it was almost $35 billion for that year in overdraft fees that were charged to people.
Yeah, and that's not
insane.
Yeah, and that's not the wealthy paying that.
That's people who are the poor that can't afford that.
That really can't afford that. Yeah, so banks have really been really predatory when it comes to overdraft fees and the way that they manage accounts for customers. And there have even been incidences in which banks manipulate how checks are cleared so that they can charge more overdraft fees.
One of the many things that banks do to go out and take money from people.
To take money from people, yeah. Yeah. So. They're actually in the business of taking money from people, which is why Bernie Sanders is saying what we need is something akin to a public bank that provides banking services to people through, say, their local post office branch, that isn't going to just prey on them and charge as many fees as they can.
And then things like state banks,
North Dakota has. Which we could have here in the state of Washington if we had the political will. Now, I want to talk about Kamala Harris's plan. I call it the poverty is mostly about race and gender plan. She would like to institute a tax credit of up to $6,000 for working families. She would like to pass the Rent Relief Act to provide a tax credit for people spending more than 30% of their income on rent and utilities. She would use federal funds to subsidize childcare so no family pays more than 7% of their income on childcare. But unlike Sanders' plan, it wouldn't be free for anyone. It would just be capped at 7% for all families. She supports the Equal Pay Plan, requiring companies with 100 or more employees to obtain, quote, an equal pay certification to prove that they're not paying women less than men. She would force companies to disclose their pay policies and prevent them from asking about prior salary history during the hiring process. And she would require companies to report the percentage of women they have in leadership positions and among their top earners. She would find companies that don't provide equal pay and invest that money in universal paid family and medical leave policies. She would promote policies that build wealth in communities of color, including investing $100 billion in down payment and closing cost assistance to homebuyers who live in historically redlined neighborhoods. She would allow the payment of rent, phone bills, and utilities to count towards credit scores, not just whether or not you already have a credit card or a student loan or an automobile debt that you've made payments on. She would also allow that the regular routine and timely payment of rent, phone bills, and utilities to count towards your credit score, which would help lower income people. She would strengthen anti-discrimination laws, and she would increase funding for the housing, education, and counseling program to help lower income folks. She would boost federal grant money and other resources to historically black colleges and universities and to minority business owners. So really her plan focuses a lot on discrimination as a cornerstone of how people have been driven down into the lower levels of the economy. And she would try to remove those constraints. So she's really focused more on relieving poverty for folks who are poor because of their race and their gender identity. Now, Pete Buttigieg, I call his plan the few more tweaks than Biden plan. he has a little bit more going for him than Joe Biden, and I'll just talk about it a little bit here. He wants to pass a law to spur entrepreneurship and job creation in underserved communities. He would force companies to make public the pay gap between men and women in their workplaces and push to pass the Paycheck Fairness Act. So a little piece from Kamala Harris there. He would pass the Equality Act and the Equal Rights Amendment, including removing the deadline on the ERA. He would strengthen anti-discrimination, anti-harassment protections, and protections for pregnant workers. So he has taken a big page from Kamala Harris's playbook here. He would strengthen labor union protections, like ensuring equal airtime on company time, so that unions can talk as well about their policies, not just company, not just the company giving their side of the story. He would give preference to unionized companies for federal contracts and right-to-work laws, and stop companies from permanently replacing workers who go on strike, a page taken from Bernie Sanders' book. And I'm sure Joe Biden would probably support some of these policies as well, though he hasn't said that he any specifics. Buttigieg says he would guarantee access to paid sick family and medical leave, but he doesn't give specifics on what that means. He would raise the minimum wage to $15 per hour. Again, another thing that Joe Biden has been a leader on. He would invest federal funds in childcare and early childhood education programs. He would pass a Community Homestead Act to purchase abandoned properties in pilot cities that need revitalization, and set up a federal fund to invest in affordable housing. He would change the Federal Arbitration Act so people can sue credit card companies that rip them off. He would work to pass strict regulations on predatory lenders, though he's not specific about which regulations and what they would do. He would revive the enforcement authority of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which I would hope all the Democrats would do. He would also strengthen antitrust standards, something that Elizabeth Warren has been very specific about doing. And he's got, of course, more going here than Biden does, and his tweaks go a little bit deeper, but he's not talking about a federal jobs program like Bernie Sanders or a really super comprehensive workplace democracy plan. And he's not talking about literally redistributing a portion of the super wealthy's multi-billion dollar hoard like Elizabeth Warren is talking about. So Buttigieg kind of falls in between Joe Biden's more vague policies, a few tweaks to the current system, and total kind of trying to redistribute wealth or restructure the system like Bernie Sanders. So that is my wrap up of the top five economic justice plans by the top five candidates. I want to remind folks that the September Democratic presidential debate is going to be held next week on Thursday. There's a total of 10 candidates who have qualified: Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, Kamala Harris, Pete Buttigieg, Beto O'Rourke, Cory Booker, Amy Klobuchar, Andrew Yang, and Julian Castro. And I want to talk a little bit, too, about the climate town hall that was held this week. A full 7 hours of questioning each of the top 10 candidates on their climate policies.
There were some breaks in there.
There were some breaks, yeah. And there were some differences. They had a lot of similar policies. And I did talk earlier, back a few weeks ago, about the different climate change policies by the top five or six candidates. And you can go back through our archive on our website, kodx.seattle. Click on the local shows and select Eat the Airwaves to get to our page.
kodxseattle.org.
Yeah, org, not com. Yeah, you click on the local programs tab and select Eat the Airwaves to find our archives, and you can click back through our previous shows to find the one on the climate plans. They did have some differences, though, and I'm focusing on a couple of the major differences. One was on nuclear energy. There's been this discussion among some Democrats saying that we need nuclear energy as a clean energy source to get to zero emissions, because climate change is a huge problem and it's impending. You know, we're suffering the effects of it now. And there are others who say that replacing one bad technology with another bad polluting technology is nuts. And I kind of agree with them. Among the 10 Democratic candidates that participated in the climate town hall, Cory Booker and Andrew Yang both said that, yes, we need nuclear energy to get to zero emissions. Kamala Harris said that she doesn't like the toxic waste of nuclear power plants. I mean, who does? But she would let states decide whether or not to build new nuclear power plants. Klobuchar said that no nuclear power plants. She would want no new nuclear power plants until we have a safe waste storage system, which essentially means no nuclear power plants. And then Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren both said no outright. and that existing nuclear power plants should be dismantled. So those were the two who were definite no's on nuclear power. Natural gas, when it comes to natural gas, because again, like we talked about earlier in the show, there are some Democrats who agree with the oil industry and with real estate developers that, oh yeah, natural gas is a clean power source.
It's natural.
It's natural. Well, no, it's not natural. When asked about a fracking ban, because most natural gas is now produced in the United States through fracking, Sanders, Warren, and Kamala Harris said that they would support a ban on fracking nationwide. Julian Castro said, let's let states decide. And he was kind of on the spot because he had previously supported fracking and natural gas as a bridge fuel towards a clean fuel economy. Amy Klobuchar said, no, she would not ban fracking nationwide because it is an important transitional fuel. So she's still thinking in terms of, well, we're back 30 years ago where natural gas is still a transitional fuel, but honey, now it's not. Joe Biden says that he would oppose new fracking on federal lands, but he would not support a full ban nationwide. So that's where some of the top candidates sit on that. And now also the fact that we had a climate town hall prompted two of the five leading candidates to finally release their climate plans. Elizabeth Warren came out and said that she is adopting Jay Inslee's comprehensive climate plan, which means that new buildings would have zero emissions by 2028, that all electricity generation would be carbon neutral by 2030, and new passenger cars, trucks, and buses would be zero emission by the year 2030. That's an aggressive timeline. Most of the other candidates put their zero emission deadline at 2050. Inslee says 2030, and that's only 11 years from now. And Elizabeth Warren is saying, yes, I think that should be our goal. She would prohibit fossil fuel leases on public lands, and she has upped her package to invest in green tech research and manufacturing and export from $2 trillion to $3 trillion, and she would pay for this by reversing the Trump tax cuts, which lead me to ask the question, okay, so what are you going to use to reverse the huge federal budget deficit that we have now that was brought on by the Trump tax cuts? I'm assuming that reversing the Trump tax cuts would be needed to pay that down, but she's saying she would use it instead for green tech, for her green tech research development and manufacturing and export of green technology. Kamala Harris also released her climate plan this week. She's saying that the U.S. should be carbon neutral by 2045, 5 years sooner than the other candidates. I think that's kind of arbitrary, just to kind of set her apart. She is calling it a $10 trillion plan with the money to come from a pollution fee and stopping fossil fuel subsidies, and I'm not sure that that's enough to collect $10 trillion. She's also saying that her plan would be would cause the U.S. to have electricity be carbon neutral by the year 2030. I'm wondering about that. She's also saying that under her plan, passenger automobiles would be 50% of them would be zero emissions by 2030, and the rest would be zero emission by 2035. That's an aggressive timeline. She wants to institute a green jobs training program that would provide $8,000 per worker to retrain for jobs in the green economy. And her plan would also call for opposing new fossil fuel infrastructure. But then when she was questioned about fracking in the climate town hall, she said that she wouldn't ban it nationwide. She would let states decide. So I'm not sure she's quite up to speed on the provisions of her own green climate plan. So that's where those two candidates sit on those new policies.
All right. Well, anything else on that?
No. Let's talk a little bit. The Trump administration this week is sitting on disaster recovery funds.
And they're very clear on their policies.
Yeah. Now, the New York Times reported this on Friday, that the Trump administration is sitting on more than two-thirds of the $107 billion that Congress has approved in disaster aid to help people recover from natural disasters like Hurricane Dorian and the wildfires of 2017 and 2018. This was specifically for the years 2017 and 2018. FEMA has spent all but $8 billion. I think they were given something like $37 billion. So they've spent all but $8 billion, but they're still sitting on that's a sizable chunk. HUD, on the other hand, these are the two agencies that really tackle responses to disasters. FEMA is the first responders. HUD is for the long-term rebuilding of communities, particularly rebuilding infrastructure like roads and waste treatment plants and water plants, and helping people rebuild their houses if they don't have like flood insurance, for example, or helping people or helping businesses rebuild after a disaster. HUD has spent only 1%, only 1% of the $73 billion that Congress gave it to spend on disaster recovery for 2017 and 2018. And I put that directly at Ben Carson's door. What is he doing sitting on that pile of cash? But also, there are other reasons related to the Trump administration. For example, the Republicans in the Trump administration are so worried that that even $1 might get spent on fraud, that they're forcing states and local communities to fill out a ton of paperwork, and then all of that paperwork has to be reviewed multiple times before any money gets approved. In addition, states are worried that if they take the money and spend it, and the Republicans perceive that it got spent on frivolous projects or something that wasn't effective, that the federal that the Trump administration will try to get the states to pay that money back to the federal government. So some of the states are also undergoing multiple reviews of paperwork before it gets submitted to the federal government. So there's the Republicans who complain about layers of bureaucracy have actually
created
many, many layers of bureaucracy here when it comes to money that needs to get spent and needs to get spent quickly in order to help these communities recover from these major, major storms. Like, for example, Hurricane Maria devastating Puerto Rico last year. Puerto Rico is still struggling just to get clean water and electricity going, much less getting their neighborhoods rebuilt. And HUD's sitting on $73 billion that they have not spent. Just only spent 1% of it. That's unconscionable.
Just a couple minutes left. Thoughts on Hurricane Dorian?
Hurricane Dorian, yeah. We talk about whether or not climate change is impacting weather systems. Well, we know Hurricane Dorian was as bad as it is because of climate change. The upper atmosphere currents are weakening because of climate change, and that caused Hurricane Dorian to sit over the Bahamas for 2 full days. That's unprecedented, and wreak extreme damage on the northeast of the Bahamas, but for the most of the Bahamas, literally are digging out from under Dorian. We also know too that Dorian was a particularly slow moving storm because of those weakening currents in the tropics. Also, Dorian was carrying way more moisture than storms have in the past. So we think about our ancestors. You know, I see comments all the time from people saying, how did our ancestors survive these kinds of storms? Well, our ancestors didn't have to survive a Dorian-type storm. Storms there certainly got to be, the category levels talk about the wind speed of the storm. Doesn't talk about how long it sits somewhere. Doesn't talk about how much moisture it dumps, or the storm surge that comes in off the ocean to flood beaches and inland areas. Doesn't talk about how big the storm is in area. There was a point at which the cloud cover from Dorian could be seen as far south as Florida, all the way up to Nova Scotia. 2,000-mile wide cloud cover for that storm, and that is just unprecedented. But we're beginning to see year after year these unprecedented Category 5 storms develop and then hit regions of the United States and its territories. We have a president who's not only denying climate change, but he's denying the fact that that storms year after year now are Category 5, are bigger in size, and are more destructive than they've ever been.
Hey, he's never heard of Category 5s.
Yeah, every time a new Category 5 comes along, he just has never heard of it. Yeah.
All right. So we're out of time. I want to squeeze in. There's a couple events this week that I think listeners might want to know about. They're both on Wednesday, September 11th. From first one, 6 to 8 p.m., it is Orca for All campaign. Launch is taking off this coming Wednesday.
Make bus passes free.
Yep.
Or very low cost.
6 to 8 p.m. at 215 Columbia Street, Suite 300. 215 Columbia Street, Suite 300. And you can find out more from Seattle Transit Riders Union. Mm-hmm. So in case you want to look that up online. And then also this Wednesday, 7:30 p.m. at Town Hall Seattle, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz will be in conversation with Nikita Oliver, talking about Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz's book, Indigenous People's History of the United States, the new edition out for young people, I believe is the subtitle. So it's specifically mm-hmm. for a slightly younger audience, or all of us that are still
for
young at
all heart. Of us who need that history.
That's right. And it's a great book. So I haven't read the new edition, but the one for adults is really good. So
it's very good.
That's Town Hall Seattle, 7:30 this coming Wednesday.